Hello, I'm Robert Royal, and I'm the editor-in-chief of The Catholic Thing. I'd like to welcome you to this latest in our series of Catholic Thing podcasts. For those of you who don't already know us, The Catholic Thing is an online daily column series, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. Our columns are short by design, under 1,000 words, so that while drinking a cup of coffee or in just a few minutes, you can get a brief but substantial commentary on faith and reason or the church in the world by some of the very best Catholic writers and thinkers. You can subscribe to The Catholic Thing. It's free by going to our website, www.thecatholicthing.org, all lowercase, and enter your email address. It's simple, and you'll receive the column every day in your inbox at 6 a.m. Give it a try. We're sure you'll be glad that you did. Hello, and welcome to our latest Catholic Thing podcast. We're delighted to have with us today Robert Riley, who's the author of a stunning new book called America on Trial. Bob, you and I have known each other for years, but I've got to say that as impressed as I've always been by your work, this thing, I read it when I gave you a publication blurb for it, and I reread it just recently, and I think it's one of the most amazing compilations of philosophy, of history, and reflection on where we are in America that I've read in quite a while. So I'm very happy that you were able to make time to be with us today. Could you just start us out by telling us a little bit, why did you feel that this book needed to be written? I think some of us know that there's a controversy going on even within Catholic circles right now. Patrick Deneen and Michael Hanby and Rod Dreher and others have talked about a flaw in the American founding. And of course, that argument has been made before, but it's being made, I think, in a more insistent way recently. So give us a little bit of background about why it is that you wanted to write this book at this moment.
Sure, Bob. Well, first of all, thank you very much for those kind remarks. Coming from you, they're particularly appreciated. As you say, this critique of the United States and its founding is not new. So the question is, why is it gaining more purchase today? And what I suggest in the book is that it's a function of the further moral decline of America that has gotten so egregious in terms of the flood of pornography, drugs, abortion, the dissolution of the family, et cetera, the people are desperate for an explanation of why. Why is this happening to us? Who did it? And therefore, more attention is given to this explanation that America's original sin was its founding, that it was a kind of time-release poison pill, and we're its victims. And what was the poison pill? According to thinkers such as Deneen and Hanby, it's the principle enlightenment, radical enlightenment principles of individual autonomy. And given various Supreme Court rulings in the public life of the United States, it's not strange that they should think so. You read Justice Anthony Kennedy in some of his Supreme Court rulings on where he finds sodomy in the Constitution and the right to same-sex marriage. He uses the language of individual autonomy, a phrase that would be completely unfamiliar to the founders of the United States. Sure. So one can, therefore, thinkers like Hanby and Deneen say that the American founding was a product of the radical enlightenment, and that there's really not a tremendous amount of difference between it and, say, the French Revolution, which is so transparently a product of that enlightenment, and it just took longer for its ugly aspects to manifest themselves because this was such a thoroughly Christian country, and as it has de-Christianized itself, the true nature of this has come out.
Yeah, I think one of the striking things about your book is the way you distinguish between the American Revolution, which is a revolution actually in favor of tradition, at a time when the divine right of kings has kind of gotten out of hand, and that's why we rebel against George III, and the kind of radical, you know, freewheeling revolution that you see in France. I think we ought to also say for the viewers at home that neither you nor I are criticizing the correct critique that Dineen and Hanby are making about where we stand right now, that in fact, we've got something that's a very un-American sort of public space these days, in which those very solid principles that existed at the time of the founding have been slowly undermined by progressivism and by judicial activism and whatnot. But Hanby and Dineen, we have to say, are correct about the fact that we are in a terrible crisis right now.
They're very good on this subject. Diagnosing these ills is one of their terrific strengths. And particularly, I would say Hanby is a very good metaphysician.
Yeah.
And he has shown that in terms of classical metaphysics, once you remove formal and final causality, you end up in an aimless, endless revolution, which we are living through today as we go from LGBT to gender mutilation and the next absurdity. So, yes, I don't contest that they're very, very good in that respect. I'd simply take them to task for saying it's the fault of the founding, when in effect, it's explicitly a denial of the founding's principles. And I use a handy quote from Obama to illustrate this. I mean, the founding, of course, was made in a certain understanding of transcendent principles, eternal truths about man, without which there would be no such thing as the American founding. Here is an illustrative remark by Barack Obama in his book, The Audacity of Hope. I think it's very helpful, very illustrative. Here's what he said, quote, "Implicit in the Constitution's structure, in the very idea of ordered liberty, was a rejection of absolute truth. The infallibility of any idea or ideology or theology or ism, and any tyrannical consistency that might lock future generations into a single unalterable course," unquote. So the truth doesn't set you free, it the truth enslaves you. So right. we have to jettison these transcendent truths, which means in effect jettisoning the founding and our republic, and it's why we're losing our republic.
Let's dig into this a little bit more, because I think one of the most striking chapters in your book is when you actually dig into the philosophical and theological background of the founders, that they quote people like Richard Hooker, but they're also interested in Suarez, they're interested in Robert Bellarmine. And I think a lot of people don't seem to understand, they kind of assume that because America is a Protestant founding in the 18th century, that it must be a departure from the ancient, not only Christian, but also classical principles. Could you talk quite a bit about the classical world and the way that that Aristotle and Plato bring us to those ideas of rational truths that are applicable for all human beings? So I'm just curious, you know, whenever I teach the period around the founding, I always include some quotations from Adams and Jefferson and others. And I'll say to the students, who said that? You know, who said that our Constitution was only for a moral and religious people? It makes no sense for any other. And they'll say, well, maybe it was so-and-so. I say, yeah, you know, it's right. It could have been any of them, because virtually all of them had this steady background that might not have been the fullness of what Thomas Aquinas might have written in terms of natural law, but they had a deep sense that there was a commonality to all of mankind about these basic truths. Where is the freedom? Where do our inalienable rights come from, if not from the Creator? It becomes very difficult to figure out where human freedom and human rights come from. So I'm just curious, could you elaborate a little bit for our viewers, where that comes from, and how deep did that actually run among the founders?
Well, when you use your "who said this" technique in your class. You know, in one chapter of the book, I put side by side quotations from Robert Bellarmine, from Francisco Suarez. I use those two because they were the most powerful critics of the idea of the divine right of kings, the absolute power of the kings, who, of course, denied there was such a thing as popular sovereignty, the equality of all people, the requirement of consent, the right to representation, or the right to revolution against tyrants. Who would have thought that it was a Catholic cardinal in Italy and a Spanish Jesuit who so powerfully articulated the natural law teaching against these things and restored the medieval understanding of constitutional principles, from which, by the way, all of those things originated. Sovereignty of the people, the requirement of consent, etc. Those were all developed in the Middle Ages. And Algernon Sidney, of course, was the famous Anglican in England who was considered such a hero in the American colonies, who absorbed all of these, who had read Bellarmine, who had read Sir Robert Filmer, who wrote his book against Bellarmine and Suarez, trying to defend the divine right of kings. Jefferson had Filmer's book, so he knew what Bellarmine had said too. So I put Bellarmine, Suarez, and the Virginia Declaration of Rights and statements from the Declaration of Independence, and they, as you know from reading it, they could be paraphrases of each other. Who said all men are created equal? Well, Robert Bellarmine said that well before John Locke or Jefferson. So this is the medieval roots of this. Ellis Sandoz is one of the finest scholars of the American Revolution. And Ellis, as you know, is himself a Protestant, but he's not at all shy in putting forth the view that the American Revolution was a counter-revolution to restore the medieval principles of constitutionalism.
Right. Somehow there's been what we might almost call a black legend that's grown up, that the medieval period was the period of absolutism, and that America and the Enlightenment were a revolt against that. When in fact, some people watching this, of course, will know it already, but most people don't. They sort of think that the period of the divine right of kings is the medieval period, which of course is false, because all kings are in the medieval period are responsible to God and to those divine principles. And it's little by little in the 16th and 17th and 18th century that there's this creeping absolutism, and that's why we revolt against George III in the first place. Well, I want to bring up a name that I know you talk about a lot in the book, and some people may not be familiar with, and that is Thomas Hobbes. That Hobbes thinks of the world as a war of all against all, and that only the Leviathan, only the absolute king, the absolute ruler and authoritarian can control these impulses of human beings, and that's what the basis of a well-run society ought to be. How did we ever decide that this was somehow identified with the American founding?
Well, first of all, before we can address the subject of Hobbes, you know, the principle, the fulcrum in the book is the tension between the primacy of reason and the primacy of will and power. And the primacy of reason was manifest in classical Greek philosophy, in Plato and Aristotle, and Cicero. And the primacy of will was manifest in the denial of the existence of natural law, and that creation, or that the universe was simply arbitrary. At the level of theology, this was expressed, say, by Thomas Aquinas, who said that will follows upon reason in the divine essence of God. So reason rules, will follows. this theological idea was flipped by William of Ockham in the late Middle Ages, and also taken up by Luther. No, it's primacy of the will. The will rules and reason follows. As later thinkers like David Hume would say, the reason is an instrument of the will to find the easiest way to fulfill what the will wishes. Now, if that's true, if the will is primary in God, that means there's no order in nature. Actually, there is no nature. And there is no natural law. There's no Aristotle's ethics. Man can't know that because God's will is arbitrary. He can change it.
And that's what we're saying right now, of course. And then the Injustice Kennedy's famous mystery passage where the freedom is the absolute capacity to define your own meaning of the universe. You're not subject either to nature or nature's God. You're absolutely free to define reality. And we see this, of course, in transgenderism and some of the more bizarre manifestations of our culture.
So in Luther, he would say that there's no natural law, or to the extent it is, man's reason is so corrupt, he can't know it. The only way you can know right from wrong is through sola scriptura, is through revelation. Otherwise, there is no way. And this corruption is only relieved by God's saving grace, which he provides arbitrarily on the select. So you could sort of think of man as a pile of manure, and the grace is the snow that falls on top of it. And this grace doesn't work with nature. It covers it.
Yeah, it doesn't transform us.
It doesn't transform it. Well, again, totally against what Thomas Aquinas taught. Now, what Hobbes's variation on this is that, yes, man is this pile of manure, but there is no saving grace. There is no snow falling upon this manure. And he then builds his political theory on this idea of the war of all against all, to which the remedy is the absolute sovereign state. And by absolute, I mean you have conjoined in that sovereignty both swords, the secular sword and the sword of the church, because the prince or the king is the head of the church, the head of the state. There is no transcendent end to man in which he will enjoy eternally felicity or suffer eternally in hell. Those things are only here. An earthly hell and an earthly heaven, which you can have either way depending on your relationship with this absolute sovereign. So, yes, we are seeing manifestations of that today, particularly during the time of the virus, when the face of Leviathan in this country becomes clearer and clearer. But to say, Bob, that this was connected to the American founding is almost comical, when it's completely antithetical to the American founding, which was restoring the primacy of reason against the primacy of will.
I say quite often, this is the devil operating in public, that for the devil, the truth is a lie is the truth, the up is down, right is left, and all such things. I ought to say for our viewers, you've written other books about this question of will and reason. You've got The Closing of the American, of the Muslim Mind, which talks about how in Islam, Allah has this will is primary and reason is secondary, that he can will anything, even contradict himself from one period to the next. Your book on Making Gay Okay, I think, touches on some of the same basic fundamental philosophical themes where nature and God disappear and then you just define yourself however you want. A lot of people refer to you as a polymath when I talk to them about you. You've also got books about modern classical music. Tell us a little bit about yourself, because I think a lot of our viewers probably know you through one or more of these books that I've just mentioned, but you've got a long history. We knew each other going back to the Reagan White House years in the 1980s, but just fill us in a little bit about your background. And we know that you've got many arrows in your quiver, but I think we'd just like to know a little bit about Robert Riley.
Well, Bob, if I could first say that my oldest son made a lovely remark about the three books you mentioned. He said they're a trilogy. Others might not see an immediate connection. What's a book about Islam, a book against the same-sex marriage, and now a book on the American founding? Because the foundation of all of them is natural law. I'm a natural law guy. And in fact, we could include the book on modern music when I try to give a diagnosis of how ugliness became a norm. And it was, as I tried to show, it was a denial of natural law in the world of sound, that music can be anything you say it is, etc. Well, I think to the extent I got an education, I went to a Jesuit school, so these kinds of ideas were not unusual there.
And it was a different age for Jesuits, though.
It was a different age. It was, but I could see when I was at Georgetown University in the late 60s, I could see the classical Catholic education disintegrating before my eyes. I should say I went to a Holy Cross Brothers school before that, which was extremely good and very rigorous. And then some years later, I went to Claremont Graduate School, where I studied with Harry Jaffa and others in political philosophy, that was also excellent. I had the privilege of working for the Intercollegiate Studies Institute for almost 8 years, which was the great fun of basically organizing my own graduate school, because if I could get 20, 30 other students to attend, ISI would pay for it. And through those means, I got to know and learn an enormous amount from the great Gerhard Niemeyer at Notre Dame. And of course, both of us learned so much from the great Father James Schall.
Sure.
And Russell Kirk, Thomas Molnar. I could go through the litany of great American conservative intellectuals from that era. And so it was, I was the beneficiary of all that. As I say, the book is not in any way original. I could blame it on all my teachers, except for any faults, of course, which are my own. But it was because I was given by them such a strong background in these areas, in theology and in philosophy and political philosophy, that helped me write a book such as this or the other books, which you were kind of.
Well, it's beautifully researched, it's beautifully argued, and it's beautifully written too, Bob. I can't praise it enough, and I hope people will go out and buy it. We're getting short on time, so let me just ask you finally. We've got to have hope for the future. We're not going to be locked down forever. What would you like to see happen? I mean, what would be Bob Riley's ideal for what happens in America going forward, so that we return? It's not simply a return to our own American founding, but it's a return to sanity. It's a return to reality. Father James Schall, you just mentioned, always used to talk about, and he wrote for the Catholic Thing quite often for years since we started, that the standard for us is what is. That's a phrase that's used in Plato. That the truth of reality, the substance of reality, the most real things in the world that are the standards for us as human beings and for human society collectively, this is what's most important. So we're not just talking about some kind of American eccentricity. We're talking about the great tradition of the human race. So how do we get from where we are now to where many of us would like to be?
Well, Bob, I'd say I'm a pessimist in respect to the erosion of the American character and the condition of moral degeneracy in which our country is. I'm an optimist because the principles on which the United States was founded are sound. And that's why I critiqued the critics like Dineen and Hanby, because they leave us without any hope, you know? And therefore, it's a return to those principles, which indeed means a restoration of the natural law understanding that there is an order in the universe, which is rational, because behind it is a God who is logos, who is reason. And we are given our freedom, endowed with it by him, in order to operate according to those laws of nature and of nature's God, which is why we heard George Washington in his first inaugural address speak of the indissoluble union of virtue and happiness. As you well know, the founders, the few theists, of course, most of them were Christians, were unanimous in saying this form of government, this republic, is more dependent than any other form of government on the virtue of its citizens. Lose that virtue and you will lose your republic. But we can't know even what virtue is until we know what is. That is, what things is it to which man's soul and being is ordered? So that's the restoration of natural law that I speak. And I think it's coming back. I see it even in the Protestant world.
We can all hope after this lockdown that God grants us some graces to be open again to these eternal truths. Bob, we could go on for forever. And I hope maybe we can get you back and maybe talk a bit more in detail about some of the subjects that we brought up today. But we're at the end for today. And so thank you for joining us at the Catholic Thing podcast. And we hope to see you again very soon next time.
Thank you.